You know, one of the fun things, I think, about mental illness, and honestly, that's, aside from race cars, that is what this show is about, is my mental illness in making the show, and I suppose yours for listening to it. One of the fun things about it is just how sometimes you're just a totally different person from one day to the next. So I was just sitting around minding my business. I hadn't thought about this show for a year, maybe. Whenever it was that I dropped the god-awful 917 episode, and if you listened to it, I apologize. I hadn't thought about the show since then. I uploaded it, and I promptly forgot that it existed. I've done other things. I had not given this show any other thought. And then last Friday or something like that, it got into my head that I'm like, you know what? I'd like to do an episode of the Race Car Podcast where I talk about a couple of loser cars. And then, I don't know, 24 hours later, I had written like 3,500 words and had a full-on script for an episode, which I feel much better about than the 917 episode. It's honestly, I couldn't really feel much worse about the 917 episode. Because, I don't know, if you go back and you listen to the other episodes of the show, I don't give a shit about cars like the 917 or the Mercedes W12, all-time great winners. I don't find that all that interesting. And I guess maybe I'm alone in that, but I mean, I had so much better a time making the show about the Nissan GT-R LM Nismo, which is maybe the most colossal failure of all time. Because I mean, something like the Life, the 190 or whatever, everybody knew that that was going to be trash, whereas like this was a full factory effort and it was this revolutionary thing and it sucked. And I find that so much more interesting. And, you know, there's been plenty of dominant winners. So, you know, the 917, Audi R8, the aforementioned W12. And it's difficult for those to be interesting to me. And the only one I can think of offhand that was really, that I find really interesting was like the Braun GP001. I thought about doing an episode about that car, but it's not an interesting car. It had one interesting part on it, just the double diffuser. And by mid-season, Red Bull had a better version of it. And by the end of the season, the Red Bull was the better car. It was just, you know, the Braun came out of the gate so hard that, you know, that was pretty much the story. And then, you know, the Braun, you know, Honda becomes Braun, becomes Mercedes. So, but what I find interesting is, I think I might have called it try-hard losers. And they're not always losers in the way that the GTR LM Nismo is. They're losers just in that they didn't win a race, but maybe that wasn't their goal. So, I don't know. It's just people that they had an idea, they executed it, and maybe the idea was a miserable failure, or maybe the idea actually succeeded, but, you know, but it was just such a niche, narrow thing that it's not a car that you could really consider a success. And that's sort of a thing that I find interesting. So what I've done is I've picked out four of these cars that, you know, they had their idea, and maybe it turned out that the reason that nobody else was doing what they did was because it wasn't a good thing to do. Or maybe they had the reverse flash thing going, where they had a goal that was just beyond anybody else's understanding. But I picked out four cars that you'll find out there's a thread that runs through them, and it's just, I don't know, they're interesting cars. So I'm calling this episode Beautiful Losers, and I like Bob Seger, so that's the main reason I'm calling it that. But, you know, maybe they're losers. Well, the first one is undoubtedly a loser. But after that, it's harder to tell. But I'm not going to change the title of the episode, because honestly, I picked out 5 cars to begin with, and there were much more losers, and then I ended up finding better ones. So we're still going to call it Beautiful Losers, because I'm not going to let the facts stand in the way of a really good title for the episode. But anyway, so this is, I guess, the Race Car Podcast is back. So let's get into it. I said a second ago that not all of the cars here are losers, but this one definitely is, because so we're going to start out kind of hot. And I'm going to give you 2 words, guys, and 2 words which, when taken separately, are at worst totally harmless, and at best they're actually quite good, but when they combined, they came together to form as big a failure as racing has ever seen. And those 2 words are MasterCard and Lola. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Lola had actually already been in the F1 business pre-95, which is when the first testing of this car took place, and that they supplied chassis to a bunch of teams. LaRousse, Haas, which is no relation to the current Haas team. This would be Carl Haas, not Gene Haas. Scuderia Italia, and a few others. They did have some success. LaRousse had actually achieved a podium. It might have gotten stripped. I don't know. I couldn't find great information about that. And we all know Lola in general is a very well-regarded firm, which is sort of what makes the rest of the story so bizarre. So Lola decides they want to do their own team, full stop, engine, chassis, everything. The first prototype runs in 95, and the plan is to start racing in 1998. So Lola would actually end up running the Ford Z-Tech R, but the original plan was for them to supply their own engine, which is to be a V10 designed by Al Melling. This was optimistic, but they're Lola. When you think about it now, it does seem like a lot, but Lola at the time was one of the top racing car manufacturers in the world, and it's probably not nearly as far-fetched an idea as it sounds like now. If anybody should have been capable of it in 1995, Lola should have been capable of it. So, but that V10 engine, the Al Melling engine, was actually a large part of the problem. Delays in bringing it to fruition resulted in very little running time for the car. There was, though, another tiny issue, which is that the car never saw the inside of a wind tunnel. Like, yeah, you're Lola, you know how aero works, but this is how you're going to go about it. The car actually ended up borrowing very heavily from Lola's IndyCar at the time. And IndyCar aero, I guess if you look at them, they look similar, but IndyCar aero is nothing like as advanced as F1 aero was in the mid-1990s. It's just, we're talking apples and, like, horses. You know, just totally separate things. But even then, with this vaporware V10 engine and the car never seeing the inside of the wind tunnel, the biggest issue that they had was the sponsor. The biggest issue was MasterCard. Because the plan originally was to start in 1998, but MasterCard says, no, we want them on the grid in 97. And the problem there was that Lola had to do it because of the dumb, stupid deal that they made with MasterCard. It wasn't a straight sponsorship deal like it is now. Haas just had got MoneyGram as a title sponsor, which is great, which means that, you know, they put the name MoneyGram on the cars, and MoneyGram cuts Haas a big old check, and Haas can spend that however they see fit. That wasn't the deal that MasterCard made with Lola. Any money that Lola got from MasterCard came directly from MasterCard's, quote, F1 club for cardholders. So Lola would not see a dime if MasterCard didn't get club members, and MasterCard wouldn't get club members without the car on track. So Lola was forced to the grid a year early. And as we all know in Formula One, rushing your preparation is what wins races. So, for all of this, the Lola T9730 is what the car was called. It showed up at the 97 Australian Grand Prix, where their drivers were 11 and 13 seconds off of pole, respectively, which put them well outside the, at the time, the 107% rule. So they needed to be within 107% of the pole to run in the race. Lola ended up, after, you know, not making that race, they withdrew from the Brazilian Grand Prix, though not before their staff had already traveled there. And then they withdrew from the championship altogether not long after that. Over the course of the development and the not quite one race that they ran, Lola racked up over $7.5 million in debt and went into receivership over the whole thing, which I guess is the British version of bankruptcy. I don't know. The company itself was revived and would return to its roles as a successful maker of race cars. But Lola would never return to Formula One. They do, however, play a small part in our next story. In 2008, Aston Martin was running in the WEC under the Cherouz banner. Cherouz? C-H-R-O-U-Z. I don't know. I'm American. I don't go around just pronouncing French names correctly. And in 2009, it became a more official factory effort. That car was the Lola B0960, which is a closed cockpit LMP1 machine powered by a 6-liter Aston Martin V12. The car was also known as the Aston Martin DBR1-2. Fun fact, the name of that car is written how it is, DBR1-2, because the car name was a tribute not to the DBR1 racer in general, but specifically to DBR1 chassis number 2. That car won 6 races in 1959, won the WSC Championship, and is one of only 3 cars to win the WSC Championship and the 24 Hours of Le Mans in the same year. That race was won by the British driver Roy Salvadori and a great American by the name of Carroll Shelby. Anyway, though, The DBR1-2. Sorry, guys, I'm reading from my notes. All right. The DBR1-2 was a great success, entering 27 races in the Le Mans series and winning 9 of them. It ran the 24 Hours of Le Mans itself. For a time, it ran third overall before a crash put it out of the race. Aston Martin, though, they decided that they wanted to go a different route in 2010, and they brought the thing more in-house, albeit through ProDrive. They came up with a car called the AMR1 for the 2011 season. It was an open-top LMP1 racer powered by a 2-liter turbo inline 6. Open top, to me, I think was an interesting call, given that Audi and Peugeot were running closed cars at the time, and, you know, having pretty good success with it, but, you know, whatever, Aston Martin wasn't going to do that. The car debuted at the 2011 6 Hours of Castellet, where it was 5 seconds off the pole time. By the end of its short career, that would actually be the highlight for the AMR1, 5 seconds off a Toyota-powered Lola B1060 and a Pescarolo Judd. That 5 seconds would put them 11th and last among the LMP1s that qualified for the race. The car had managed 96 laps in the race, which was roughly half distance, and finished last in class, which is not terrible, I suppose, for a first effort. Next up was testing for Le Mans, where the car struggled for both speed and reliability. This resulted in the team withdrawing from Spa to continue to test for Le Mans. Did it work? It did not work. Aston Martin sent 2 cars, the 007 and the 009. The 009 retired after 2 laps. It finished 56th. That's last at Le Mans, by the way. The 007, however, did do much better, which is to say it did twice as well. It managed 4 laps over as many hours before retiring and finishing 55th. Aston Martin skipped Imola for Silverstone. They dropped the AMR1 entirely and reverted to the Lola, or the Aston Martin DBR1-2 from the previous season. Like the Lola T9730, this car did result in real consequences for Aston Martin. They blamed the public development of the car for its failure. Aston Martin withdrew from prototype racing to focus on its GT program. It would never race again, but wouldn't you know it has a connection to our next car, because one of the 2 AMR1 chassis would be sold on to be utilized in another project. Because, see, the AMR1 chassis had already been homologated for crash tests, which made it a logical and cost-effective base for the Delta Wing. So, the Delta Wing. Now, full disclosure, with me on the Delta Wing, and I think this is probably just a folly of youth, was I hated this thing when it came out. And which is so, like, runs counter to the way that I feel now about, like, if the Delta Wing came out now, I would think it was, like, the best thing in the world. But, man, did I hate the Delta Wing. Holy shit. It's just homely and just weird, and I don't know. I did not care for the Delta Wing. But anyway, back to the thing, you know, taking apart my personal opinions at the time. It was actually developed for IndyCars. They called it the Iconic Project. Iconic meant innovative. innovative, competitive, open-wheeled, new, industry-relevant, cost-effective. I think they probably came up with the acronym before they actually figured out what they wanted it to mean. But so this was a competition to create what was going to be the new IndyCar chassis for 2012. It was entered by Delta Wing, as well as Dallara, our friends at Lola, Swift, and something called Bat Engineering. Delta Wing was backed financially by Chip Ganassi, who's a fairly major player in IndyCar by any metric. Ultimately, IndyCar chose the Dallara design, which is still in use by IndyCar today, which I suppose speaks to it being a pretty good platform, but also kind of how stale maybe IndyCar has become. Honestly, though, I really don't think there was ever any chance that IndyCar would have chosen Delta Wing, even if it were by far the best. Because Delta Wing, if you're listening to this program, I'm sure you've seen a Delta Wing. If you haven't, pause it and just Google Delta Wing, and then you'll see exactly what we're talking about here. It was, let's say, radical. The rear track of the car was 5 feet 7 inches, front track was 2 feet. We say often that race cars look like darts, but the Delta Wing turned up looking like a dart to 11. It's counterintuitive, but the design resulted in faster straight line and corner speeds than the outgoing IndyCar chassis, despite having half the power. It also had half the weight and consumed half the fuel. So it was designed by Ben Bowlby and Don Panos, American maker of fun and interesting race cars, including the first hybrid prototype to ever attempt to qualify at Le Mans, which was the Q9 GTR1. It did not make the race, but it did win Petit Le Mans. But Bowlby and Don Panos took the idea of the Delta Wing to the ACO, and they secured a Garage 56 entry for Le Mans. The car retired after only 75 laps due to a collision, but its speed did put it on par with the LMP2s, which should probably be seen as a success. Now, it was also running all sorts of experimental stuff that was only legal because it was an unscored Garage 56 entry, but still, it was promising. It also finished only 6 laps off of the overall winner at Petit Le Mans. For 2013, though, it was classified as a P1, and it struggled. It was 10 seconds a lap off the leading Audi at Sebring, and 5 seconds off of its nearest rival, and it would actually end up retiring early from that race. The season as a whole really wasn't any better. They scored points only twice. They also came up with a coupe version, which did not fare very much better. For, I suppose, its relative lack of success, the Delta Wing actually had kind of a long career. It bummed around until 2017 or so, running at the back of P1 classes here or there, before new rules put it down for good. So, this is the third car. I said we're going to talk about four cars, and this should be the spot where I'm linking this car and Ben Bowlby to another famous failure, which is the Nissan GTR LM Nismo. Except I already did an entire episode about the GTR LM Nismo, which is my favorite episode I've done so far. I love that stupid, ugly, ridiculous car. But luckily, something funny did happen, and it did involve my good friend, Ben Bowlby. Bowlby left Delta Wing. He went to work with original Delta Wing engine supplier Nissan. And while, yes, that resulted in the GTR LM Nismo, before that car debuted at Le Mans in 2015, the Nissan Ziad RC was the 2014 Garage 56 entry. And so if you, whether you've Googled the Delta Wing or not, maybe pause here and Google the Nissan Ziad RC, Z-E-O-D-R-C. Because, man, does that thing look exactly like the Delta Wing. Chip Ganassi and the Delta Wing crew, who Bowlby had separated from, thought so as well. A lawsuit was brought and eventually settled outside of court, but I digress. The Ziad RC was a hybrid electric racer, had 2 goals for the race, both of which it did accomplish. One was to complete a full lap under electric power, and the other was to exceed 300 kilometers per hour. And that's pretty fast. 300 kilometers per hour was at 180-ish miles an hour in freedom units. But you know what's really fast? That's 400 kilometers per hour. And that brings us to our last car, which is a car that went to Le Mans with that goal in mind. So the guys at WM Race Cars, I think they knew their limits. Because so many times small teams will show up at Le Mans or an F1 with giant ideas of, you know, winning world championships, lasting 24 hours, and it doesn't work out. But to their credit, I suppose, WM were not about that life, and I do appreciate that. They ran Le Mans a bunch of times in prototype sports cars built effectively in their shed. But once the whole Group C thing really kind of took off in earnest with all the big manufacturers getting involved in it, any dreams that they might have had of winning the thing outright went out the window. Which is what they ended up doing. They aimed lower, but quite a lot faster. So there's a phrase that I'm fairly fond of, and it's, I'm here for a good time, not a long time. And that's kind of where they decided to be, was, you know, they're probably not going to win the race. The car probably won't last 24 hours, but we're going to go 400 kilometers per hour at Le Mans. So in 1987, they brought their car, the P87, to Le Mans. They had a good relationship with Peugeot, so they're able to put a 850 horsepower twin turbo V6 supplied by Peugeot in the car. The car was crazy unreliable, often unable to string together consecutive laps, but it did make 356 kph, which is 226 miles per hour in testing. Allegedly, on the A26 highway, the car did 418 kph, so clearly the power and the aero was there, but doing it in the race was, of course, very different. Officially in 1987, they were clocked at 381 kph, and even though the team's instrumentation said they had gotten over 400, the ACO's numbers said otherwise. They'd redoubled their efforts for 88, bringing the P87 and also the revised P88 to the race. P88 was some 130 pounds lighter, with an extra 50 horsepower and longer Venturi tunnels for increased downforce. Of course, this was the age of ground effect cars. The P87 retired after a dozen laps or so, but the P88 hung around. After spending 3 hours in the pits working on engine issues, driver Roger Dorchy was allowed to turn the wick up and see what happens. So turn the turbos all the way up, turn the engine all the way up, and what happened was 407 kph down the Mulsanne straight, and then an almost immediate engine failure that took the car out of the race. The job, however, was done, and just in time, actually. You see, you remember I said that WM had a good relationship with Peugeot? Well, if you're familiar with Peugeot, you might be familiar with this car. They had a new one coming out called the 405. And luckily, the P88 had cleared 400 by enough that it was no issue to lop 2 kph off the top, so they could use their record to advertise their new 405 by bragging about a Peugeot engine going 405 kph at Le Mans. So that does it for my selection of beautiful losers. And I don't know, I think probably going forward on this show, I'm not going to say that I'm not going to do anything with it, because I do think I'll do something with it. But I think it's going to be more cars like this than it will be cars like the 917. If it is winners, it's going to be stuff that I really care about. You know, the C5R was a cool episode. The Audi 90 was a cool episode. The Volvo 850, I think that was a good one. Although still my favorite episode was the GTR LM Nismo, and that thing fucking sucked, so... I don't know. It's going to be interesting things, not necessarily good things, but I don't know. I guess the show's back. There's not going to be any kind of release schedule. If you're still subscribed to the show, I guess you'll just kind of see it show up every once in a while, because Lord knows I don't advertise it anywhere. So, yeah. So if you listen this far, guys, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. And I will be back with something stupid in an unspecified length of time. Thanks.